myself again. But it's the only way you're ever gonna learn. You look back and it's all in the past.
Good morning, welcome to Steve Rae's True Crime Interviews, and delighted to see I'm joined by Lucky Campbell from Indonesia this morning. Good morning, Lucky.
Good morning.
Great to see you.
Actually, good afternoon in Indonesia.
Great to see you. And those of you who follow me on a regular basis will know that my company, Bad Boys Books, tends to bring out books by former criminals, and we have a fantastic story to tell this morning on this podcast by Lucky, who has not one but two books coming out with us. The first is Shanghai and Shackled. The second is The Saffron Assassin. And the two books are excellent reads. We're hoping to have these out within the next 6 to 7 weeks. You'll be able to pre-order the books now, signed copies from badboysbooks.net. And we're going to tell you a little bit about this gentleman who has joined me on screen today. So let's go back to the beginning, first of all, and just tell us a little bit about where you were born and where you were brought up.
Yeah, well, I was born in Glasgow in 1950. And I have four older sisters, one older brother, two younger brothers and myself. So total of eight. Not long after the war, 1950, so the living conditions were not very good. We lived in a one-room apartment with an outside toilet. So it was quite cramped conditions, and the living standard wasn't very good. And most of my childhood years, my father was in prison. He was quite a notorious bank robber and hijacker, so my childhood, he was in prison, most of it. And growing up, because we were such a big family, didn't have money to support us, we were often sent into childcare. So like the welfare department, the welfare system in Glasgow would send, well, my older brother, actually, I didn't meet my older brother until I was about 12. He was taken away as a child, George, and we sent to an island in Tyree. I'd heard his name before, I'd heard my mother talking about him, but I'd never ever seen this guy before. And me and my two other brothers, we went to local care homes, you know, maybe 20 miles out of the city of Glasgow. One place in particular was called Castle to Ward, which is in Dunoon. So most of my childhood was in and out of those childcare facilities.
What was it like to be in those kind of child facilities back in those days?
Well, I was very young. I mean, the first that I remember was 1955 to 1956. It was 1 year in Castlemilk. And I just remember it being like quite, as I say, disciplinary in a sense. You know, you sort of get slapped around a little bit because you're young and mischievous and nobody really to discipline you except for the staff at the care centre. So it wasn't a good experience. And as I got a bit older, like maybe 10, you can begin to understand things more. And it was more or less the same routine. I'm trying to think of a word, like you're not a family. You're part of a group of people who are cast out for whatever circumstances in the society, whether it be their parents or whether they're orphans. So it wasn't a good experience. It was quite brutal or abusive in some ways.
You mentioned your father was quite a criminal. Can you embellish on that? Can you tell us what kind of crimes and activities he got up to?
He was a lad, my father, you know. Yeah, I've got some experiences of it. Although I was young, he got out of jail when I was about, I guess I would have been about 12 also, 12 or 13. But he got, there was a guy, I Googled it because I don't know much about my father because he died not long after, when he came out of jail, he done 7 years for a bank robbery. Then he came out of jail and then just a couple of years later, he was back in doing 10 years. But I Googled him it's called Bobby Campbell's gang. His name is Robert Campbell, but called him Bobby. And he was just a very smartly dressed guy. I've seen guns. I've been in the house when the police came to the house looking for explosives. You know, I'm just a kid, but they're in with all these things and searching the house, pulled the house apart. So he was quite a well-known figure in the Scottish gangster world, the criminal world. But as I say, I never really got to know my father because he spent that much time in prison. And then eventually when he did get out, he was only out for a couple of years and he died. So
is there quite a trauma attached to that kind of thing at that age? I mean, going into care homes, witnessing the police coming in and tearing a house apart. Do you think that probably played a part in what your life became?
Very much so. Very, very much so. It made me, I was very antisocial. I didn't like police. I didn't anything to do with police. I just didn't want to know. I just didn't like them at all. And, I remember going up to visit him and he would be up in the north of Scotland, but every year they took them down to Glasgow to Berlini prison. And then there was a little glass window. So you sat, you couldn't touch or anything, but you could still talk, shouting through the glass. Maybe me, my mother and my two younger brothers, we would go up and visit my father. So it was a traumatic experience. Because you're getting dragged away again. Then you don't see them again for another year. So it was terrible. So I think it did affect my outlook in life.
What were you like at school, Lucky?
I liked school. Primary school I don't have that much memories of. I mean, I still remember going to primary school. But when I went to secondary school, I loved football. I really loved to play football. And I used to be a mad Ranger supporter. But, Glasgow City is divided in two. There's the Celtic and there's Rangers, right? So, and I went to all the games, even as a kid. Used to get lifts up in the back of a lorry, then get dropped off at Hampden Park or Celtic Park or Ibrox. Then somebody lift you over the turnstiles. Actually, one of my houses in Glasgow was opposite Parkhead Thistle's ground. So it was really handy. I used to go to the Thistle games as well. But I loved football. But as I say, there was a divide in Glasgow between Rangers and Celtic. And as a teenager, when I got to the age of 14, 15, I started to go around with this crowd called the Carlton Tongs. And they're all descendants from Ireland. They're all Irish descendant, mad Celtic supporters. So I slightly sort of drifted away from following Rangers. I didn't follow Celtic. I didn't become a traitor, but I just didn't go to the Rangers games anymore. And I love to play football. I played outside right. Oh, I love football.
I used to love it. Do you think you could have ever made it as a professional?
Nah, I'm only one-footed. I'm a one-footed player.
Okay. Did you leave school with any passes and exams? Were you educational?
No, I was, believe it or not, I was very good at school. In the secondary school, the first year I came in fourth in the class. And the second year I came in first in the class. And the third year I got expelled. I'm beginning to grow up, I'm beginning 14, 15 and starting to have an attitude. So I get kicked out of the school that I was going to. And they sent me to this other school in a different part of the city. And that's where I linked up with those guys from the Tongs, the gang. So then my life just went the wrong directions.
From the care homes, you ended up in Borstal. I mean, what was that for and what was it like going into Borstal?
Yeah, well, as I say, going about with all these young unruly youths, gang fighting, nearly everybody ended up in Borstal. So when I went to Borstal, it was just like, you got a stripe, you've got your first stripe, you're one of the boys now. And in Borstal, I found it actually quite interesting because of the exercise regime they had. We did circuit training and weightlifting, not heavyweight, small weights, but a lot of running, cardio stuff, and a lot of fighting. So Borstal, I was going to say it was good, but it wasn't a good experience. but it was good for my mind and my body. I sort of grew up a little bit there.
And at a young age for you, your mother passed away.
Yeah, I was only a boy. I was only 12, 13. Very young. She was only 42.
I mean, was that natural causes? Was it
pneumonia.
And I mean, from your perspective, you know, I guess that made you grow up even quicker. You know, you're going into care homes, your father's in and out of prison, and then your mother passes away. You know, you're left to stand on your own two feet at such a young age.
Yeah, it was very difficult because I've got four older sisters, and my sister Agnes, when my mother died, she took care of me. First of all, she's only 16. But she's now the woman of the house. I've got two, the other older sisters, my two brothers went with that, an older sister called Sadie, and she took care of them. Agnes took care of me. And then when I got into trouble, I went to an approved school in Borstal. And then when I was 17, I went to stay with my oldest sister, Helen. So I was sort of always moving around. I didn't really have a stable home, if you know what I'm saying.
And you know, from that age, you know, you're getting older, you're in with the wrong crowd. I mean, was there any chance that the young Lockie was going to be able to get out into the real world and stay on the right side of the law and get a job?
Well, I did have a go at it. When I was 19, I got married. When I was in Borstal, I'd done a painter and decorator's course. So when I came out of Borstal, I got a job as an apprentice painter and decorator. Oh, and I really liked it. I really enjoyed doing it. And then at 19, I got married. And that was not an excuse, but it was a good reason to break away from the gang. So, and it was accepted that, you know, now that you're married and you've got a responsibility. So my wife is pregnant with my son, Scott. So I did stay out of trouble for a few years. You know, I never got involved in anything at all up until I was about 23. And that's when I left the UK because my marriage dissolved. And I just started getting into drugs and selling hash and stuff like this. But nothing major, not robberies or stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're going from being in care homes to Borstal. I mean, you know, just tell us a little bit about that, you know, that jump up to slightly harder crimes. I mean, you know, it's a big jump from a bit of vandalism and a bit of tomfoolery with your mates and running around with a gang to then taking that next step up to being a career criminal, a bit of theft, etc. Yeah. I mean, you know, why did you do that? Was it because you thought, well, I need money? Is it as simple as that, or was it the buzz for the crime?
No, you got it the first time. It was to do with money. I actually went to do an armed robbery one time with two friends of mine. We went to do an armed robbery in a post office. But, you know, inside I was panicking. I just didn't want to do it. So on the way there, I managed to talk to my two mates. I don't think this is a good idea, you know, so I don't really fancy doing it. So I never did it. That was one fortunate thing. I never done that armed robbery. But the other friend of mine who was actually driving the car, he went on to do bank robberies, and eventually he served a life sentence in prison. Hmm. So I never really got into the crime scene I was a thief. I used to shoplift, and we call it creeping. Sometimes we go into a department store or a supermarket or a large groceries and try and creep into the back store, open the safe, get the money, and off. I've done that many times, and sometimes got a good bit of money, maybe 600 quid, 800 quid. One time, 1,200 quid. So it was a nice way to make an earner without taking guns or jumping over counters. You're doing it on the sly, you know, like creepy, a little creepy guy in the bank store and opening the safe. So I wasn't involved in crime, but not in a major way.
Obviously, from your perspective, you know, you were married at such a young age. I mean, why so young?
Well, my girlfriend got pregnant.
Right. Okay. So it was in those days. I guess it was probably it would be frowned upon if you left a girl standing alone with a child.
Exactly. You're spot on.
And I mean, you know, you settled down then. What was your mindset to try and give that a go? And how did you feel when your first son was born?
Yeah, well, I did have that in mind, what you're saying. Breaking away from the gang, had a good job, painting and decorating. It's not the best of jobs, but it's a steady job, good money. You can do extra work, you know, but you know, private jobs. And my intention was definitely to settle down. And when my son was born, yeah, I just sort of a good feeling to have a baby, you know. And then a strange things happened is that a friend of mine from London, Ralph McLaren, came up to Glasgow with his girlfriend, and he came to my house, and he had a lump of hash, and we just sat smoking, you know, getting stoned. Yeah, had a good time. And he asked me, "Do you want to take some LSD?" I said, "Sure, come on." Took some LSD, tripping, you know, whoa, fantastic colors and listening to music. And some thought process comes through the mind. I said to my wife, still high on acid, of course, why don't I go down to London with Ralph and I'll get a job in London and I'll send for you and Scott. Yeah, okay, that's a good idea. Went to London. One of the things I was telling about creeping into the back of a shop, got £1,200, and me and Ralph getting stoned, you know, yeah, hey, why don't we go to Amsterdam? I thought, yeah, never gave it a second thought, still coming up acid, you know, and you don't know where your head is. And off he goes to Amsterdam. And as soon as I got to Amsterdam, I bought a sheet, you know, blotting paper, they call it, blotting paper acid. Started dropping my acid, hitchhiked to Belgium, then hitchhiked the way down to Paris, all the way up through France into Spain. Again, because I had a lot of acid, so and we were partying in Spain as well, you know, like Lloret de Mar and meeting different people and dropping acid. And I don't know what happened, but 8 months had passed. And I thought, for fuck's sake, 8 months? Well, I better head home. And I never sent a letter to anybody. I never sent a postcard to anybody. And I arrived back in Glasgow and went to see my wife. And she wasn't there at that time. So I went to my mother-in-law's house and she opened the door and looked at me and just went, oh my God, look at the state of you. My hair was long, a ponytail, I had kind of an earring sticking here, a bracelet here, bangles here. Yeah, man, yeah, well, I'm just coming back from traveling. You know, head gone, you know, away with the fairies. She told me, I went and take a shower. Get yourself a job. And then I linked up with my wife again. And unknowns to me, when she must have just been pregnant as I left. Because when she came back, when I came back, I had 2 sons. Oh my, I don't even know. I didn't know about the second son. And but she quite rightfully didn't accept me back again. So I just headed down to London.
I've heard of Newcastle United fans going out for a pint of milk and ending up on a bus and ending up in an away game and then coming back with a tail between their legs and being in the doghouse with their missus for a couple of days, you know, and then maybe end up having to do a job around the house to get back in those good books. I have never, ever heard of anybody going to London to look for some work, to provide for their family, and then not coming back for 8 months. Only to find, not only is the missus still there with the Ben, but also with another one in tow. I mean, that is got to be the most bizarrest story I have ever heard. The fact as well that you didn't write, you didn't send anything. I mean, you didn't ring home or anything at that time, Lockie.
Nothing.
Wow.
Too high on drugs. You just lost, you know, lost in acid land.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's for me, that's a fascinating part of the story. So yeah, you come back, For obvious reasons, the missus has moved on. What, you know, were you still given access to your sons even though you went back down to London? Did you try and keep in touch with the sons? Did you send money back for them?
No, I didn't. I probably could have, but I was just too irresponsible.
Yeah.
I was just too much, you know, taking care of my own self, taking acid and drugs and going to live concerts, listening to bands. I just became, yeah. I mean, maybe, you know, because I'm still a young man, you know, I get married at 19, and when you're like 23, you're still a young man. You've got lots of energy and listen
wild,
to bands.
Wild oats to sow. Yeah,
exactly, sowing my wild oats. You're spot on again. So it's irresponsible, but you don't think about that at the time.
I think what your book shows is obviously, you know, nowadays reality TV, we have many ex-celebrities doing globe-trotting programs. Michael Palin was probably one of the first pioneers around the world in 80 days and all that. Your book definitely takes us on this round-the-world journey to some exotic places. And you ended up in Saudi. What were you doing there?
Yeah, well, whilst I was in London, there was an advert in the newspaper for painters and decorators for Saudi. So I went down for an interview in King's Cross, and they sent me to Belgium to do a sort of a test, put me into a room, told me to decorate the room, you know, paint the ceiling, wallpaper one wall, gloss the windows, gloss the door, gloss the skirting board. And they just observed. And they could see that, you know, because there's a system to painting and decorating. There is a certain way you've got to do things. You know, you don't paint the walls first, then go and paint the ceiling. So they know. So they gave me the job and sent me out to Saudi Arabia on a 3-month contract. And that was quite interesting. I took a lump of hash with me as well into the bargain. But crazy. You don't know the things that I've done, things that I could have been executed more than once for, in Malaysia and things like this. But yeah, I just didn't think about it. You know, I don't know, something wrong with my brain or something, or I just think that I'm invisible. I don't know what it is. But now to Saudi, and it was a really good job. The job was to 156 bungalows that they had built for the Saudi Air Force. And my job was to be decorating them. And it was a really good salary, getting about £500 up to £600 a week. And whilst I was there, you met a lot of different foreigners doing different contracts, and they were telling me, yeah, you can get a holiday after 3 months and the company will pay for it, you know? So talking to guys talking about South America or Thailand, and I thought, you know, I would like to go to India, because I always liked it, you know, I always sort of had some imagination about India. And I went to India. And I ended up staying there for 3 months. Wow, I really loved that place. You know, it still is the most craziest country that I've ever visited. And I've been in a few countries. It's just the madness and the pandemonium in the streets. You know, sometimes you see monkeys jumping up in buildings and cows are walking around everywhere on the road, you know, just trotting along on the road. The cars are driving by, and the smells and the colors and the music is wow. I loved that. You know, it just really gripped onto that. I loved it. And but just ended up buying a lump of hash, sitting about smoking dope up in a guest house somewhere, meet other foreigners.
You did a bit of yoga out there as well, didn't you?
Sorry?
You did a bit of yoga.
Yeah, I done two courses, actually. I done a teacher's training course in yoga, and I done another course with my son Scott in Nepal, in the Patanjali Yoga Center. But that was years later. But both of us done another course there. But I was supposed to be on some sort of a holiday. But most of the time I just lay about smoking. The second time I went, I done the yoga course. The first time I just got high and enjoyed myself. After 3 months, I went back to the UK and stayed in the UK again for a couple of years. And then I went back out again to India. And that's when the sort of really went off track, you know, sort of get lost. I went on a spiritual quest and ended up being a smuggler.
To tell us about that. I mean, you know, you're a free spirit. There's no doubt about that. And you know, you're living life the way you want to live it. You're making ends meet by, you know, selling a bit of hash here and there and smoking the rest. And you know, you're still trying to find yourself, I guess. That's probably the story that I get out of this. But trying to find a spiritual home, because you know, for all of those years in your early life, you didn't really have a home. You were out of the family home, you were into care homes, then you're into Borstal, and then, you know, it's just a hell of a journey. So when did you decide that smuggling was the way forward for you?
Yeah, you're very good at analysing things. The way that you put that there, from like childhood and then going into foster homes and then eventually to preschool in Borstal, still hadn't found myself yet. You're spot on, and I was still looking then. Mm. So you're correct about that. But eventually, the second time I went back to India, same again, you know, just smoking, getting stoned. After India, I went to Nepal, went to the Himalayas and trekked around the foothills there, really enjoyed myself. Again, same procedure, just smoking, getting stoned. And then I went on to Thailand. And Thailand was, again, totally different. It was very, very different from, like, India and Nepal. And nobody had ever told me about all these beautiful girls in Thailand. And it wasn't one of the traveller's tales that I ever heard. Only tales I ever heard was where you can buy the best hash, go up to Manali in the mountains, get the hand drop. Or there's a crack opium den here, try this opium den. That was the sort of a travelling tales that I was listening to. But when I went to Thailand, I checked, there was a nice little hotel there and a swimming pool, and I was sitting at the swimming pool and I was talking to two Swedish girls. And I'm looking over and there's a couple of Western guys and sitting with two gorgeous Thai girls. I'm thinking, whoa, beautiful, you know. And then the girl said, oh, they're prostitutes. I said, what? Yeah, they're prostitutes. I said, whoa. I couldn't imagine it because of a really sexy, beautiful looking girls, you know what I mean? And I mean, I obviously hadn't mind, I wouldn't mind meeting one myself, but I was in the process of only going to stay there maybe for a week and then head on to Hong Kong. But I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed Thailand, and I definitely had it in my mind, I'm coming back here again. I will definitely come back here. But I then went on to Hong Kong, and that's when the actual real smuggling began. I checked into a guest house called Chongqing Mansions and met Chinese guys there. And these Chinese guys, they had a group, and they would sit, all foreigners, mostly backpackers. And if you wanted to go from Hong Kong to South Korea, South Korea to Japan, back to South Korea, then stop off in Taiwan, and then back to Hong Kong. And they loaded you up, they paid for everything. They loaded you up with technology, like Nikon, a couple of different Nikon cameras, every lens that you can imagine, motor drive, flash. Maybe then there was Sony Walkmans, Casio calculators, a Leica camera, a Hasselblad camera. Depends how much they want you to give you. And then you could get duty-free cigarettes and your duty-free whiskey. They took you, you went in a group, maybe six of us in a group, stopped off in South Korea, gave the technology to the guy who was taking us. He would sell it in the black market. Then we'd go off to Japan. Again, he would purchase all the technology, back to South Korea, drop it off, then to Taiwan. Taiwan would pick up ginseng, drop it off in Hong Kong. And the ticket, that was a 17-day ticket. It only lasted 17 days. And the cost of that ticket was $300 American. And you could do it again and again if you wanted. So I thought, $300, I can go again next week. So I'd done it about 10 times. And then I started thinking, well, I can do this myself. I don't need to get them to do it. And I just keep all the profit, because I knew all the names of the products, the brand names, because I was carrying them that many times. And I started doing it myself. And I made a couple of $1,000s in the first trip. And okay, that was great. Then I'd done that many times. And then there was another route you could take from Hong Kong to Delhi. Same technology. And sell it in Delhi. And come back to Hong Kong. And repeat that if you wanted to do it. But of course, while in Delhi, because I'm a hash smoker, I purchase a big lump of hash. So I've got my own personal stash. Arrived back in Hong Kong. There's a good group of us, an international group of guys from all over the world, you know. And of course, they want to smoke a joint, so I share the joints with them. And then I say, hey, why don't you bring some back yourself? Oh, no, you can't do that. If we get arrested with hash, we'll go to jail. But if we get arrested with technology, they may be confiscated or they maybe have to pay tax. I thought, well, okay, next time I go back to Delhi, I'm bringing it back, I'll sell it to them. So that's how I started selling hash.
Amazing journey that. I mean, did you mess around with other drugs? I mean, obviously, you know, hash and, you know, you're talking about trips earlier on in your life. I mean, did you try cocaine? Did you try heroin?
While I was in Asia, I did smoke opium and I did take heroin sometimes. Cocaine, no. I took cocaine, the first time I ever took that was in Amsterdam, the second time I went to Holland. But I didn't like that drug, you know. The first time I took it, it was fantastic. You know, it was, whoa, man, it's the best you could ever imagine. Ooh. But I started taking it more and more. And it really made me very depressed, you know, really, really depressed. So I never, ever get into cocaine. Never. But as I say, when I got to like India, sometimes I go down to Bombay, jump into an opium den, smoke opium, lie in it. They'll get beds there. And you just lie there. You can lie there for a week or a month, up to you, as long as you get money to smoke the opium. Sometimes just lie there for 3 days, smoking the pipe, stagger out, and then go back up to Delhi. Head back to Thailand, like that.
I got to know Mr. Nice, Howard Marks, very well. And, you know, I did many, many stage shows with Howard over the years in different parts of the UK. He became a very famous, speaker. And he was very cautious. He had many identities. He had, he was a meticulous planner, very connected around the world. Reading your book, your story is very, very different. Although you were doing, you know, a similar kind of thing. I mean, were you as cautious as Howard? You know, or you know, did you let it slip a little bit? Do you think?
And reckless.
Reckless.
Totally. I don't know what my mentality or my state of mind was. I really think I was invisible. Really. Mm. I told you to go Korea, Japan, back, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, and going around and around. Of course, every time you go into a country, you get a stamp on your passport, right?
Yeah.
I never gave it second thought. Maybe the immigration might ask me, why are you coming here every 10 days? You know, I never thought about things like that. I'm going in and out and I'm going to... Actually, I was questioned about that when I was arrested in China. They noticed it. When the police arrested me and I was in the station, they're looking at the passport, they're going, what? Because it was every 2 weeks. You're in Delhi for a week, you're back in Hong Kong, you're in Korea, Japan, Taiwan for a week, you're back in Hong Kong, you're off to Delhi again. And it's just stamp, 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 stamp. You can only be a very busy, busy businessman or a smuggler. They noticed it. They said, why are you going in and out of those countries so many times, you know? I just said, I'm a businessman. I buy and sell. I do export and import. But they at least noticed it. So what you're saying, like with Howard Marks changing his passport, getting a new identity, that would have been very, very important. That was obviously the clever and smart thing to do. But it didn't cross my mind.
obviously you're making money all this time, Lockie. What were you doing with your money? Were you spending it as quick as you earned it, or were you investing it?
Well, the only investment I did make was I bought land in the Philippines and I built a house and I opened up a scuba diving school. But I just get laid back, you know. I'm on an island called Boracay Island. You go up north, you buy a kilo of weed, good quality weed, about $100. Go down to the island. Booze is cheap. I've got scuba diving equipment. I can catch fish, catch lobster, laying about. I stayed there for 5 years, never moved my ass. Well, sometimes I would go back to Hong Kong, but most of that time, I just lay about the beach and the money is going down and down and down. So when the money goes down, shoot over to Hong Kong, do a quick trip to India, pick up a 2 or 5 kilo, back to Japan, get another 50 grand, and then go and take another holiday. You know, I wasn't really a saver, you know, somebody who saved. I spent and spent. Yeah, I gave away money, you know. I remember meeting an Australian guy and his girlfriend, and she was pregnant, and they didn't have any money. I just handed the guy $7,000. I said, here, get a ticket for you and your wife and go back to Australia. That was one time I gave, that was the most I've ever gave one person at one time, 7,000. But I often give travelers, you know, backpackers $100. And when you're out drinking or having a meal in a restaurant, I'll pay it, I'll get it. I never really paid much attention to money, to be honest with you. I just used it.
Okay, the main story of the book is obviously the downfall, if you like, the arrest and subsequent conviction. Tell us about that. What happened?
Yeah, well, I phoned my brother in London, and I was asking him for phone numbers of my family members, sisters and stuff like that, because I hadn't been in touch with anyone for years. And he said, oh, your son Scott is here in London. Really? You got his number? Yeah, give me his number. And then I phoned Scott. Oh, how are you doing, Dad? I've not heard from you for years and years. Oh, I'm going to do a trip around Southeast Asia, maybe the Indian subcontinent. Do you want to join me? Oh, I've got a girlfriend. I've got a job. I said, okay, I just thought I would ask you. Yeah, okay, I'll join you. So I met up with him in Islamabad. And we traveled through Pakistan to a place called Peshawar. It's where all the Afghan rebels and Mujahideen, and they're all there, you know. It's a border town. And I had a friend there, because I'd been there many times. I used to buy carpets from him. So sometimes when I had money, as I say, I'd buy really good quality carpets and send them to my brother in London. But this time I took my son there, and we just sat around. His name is Atola, sitting in Atola, smoking the big hubbly bubbly pipe, got stoned. And I was saying to my son, look, I'm going to take 20 kilos of hash to Japan. My son says, oh, yeah, okay. But I said, you don't have to be involved in anything like that. You don't need to be part of it. So end up bought the 20 kilo. We hired a jeep all the way up the Karakoram Highway, up the Silk Road, to the border of China, crossed over the border into China, went to a little town called Kashgar. That's where that Marco Polo arrived there. He told a story about that. So I was quite happy to be there and go to that marketplace that Marco Polo had also been to. And then got a train. It's a 3-day journey from the town called Urumqi to Shanghai. So I've got the 20 kilos of hash. But it's not really concealed very well, because I've done this trip so many times. Like I explained a minute ago, maybe I thought I was invisible. I don't know what it is. I just breeze through all the time. I just go through customs, immigration. Everywhere I went, I never ever had a problem. So I've got 5 kilos of hash concealed in the false bottom suitcase. There's roughly about 7 or 8 kilos in a very large bag at the bottom of the bag, just wrapped up with plastic and towels, pots, pans, knives, forks, cups, spoons, dirty underwear, dirty socks, dirty shirts, just crammed into it. And then there's a small day pack. Got about 7 kilos in that. Again, just a couple of t-shirts and bits and pieces. So anyway, we just can't, because I've no fear about this. I've done it so many times. Just sitting on the train, I had a cabin, a private cabin, just for me and my son. And because it's a three-day journey, got a bit boring. I thought, I'll just go outside the cabin door, look out the other side of the train window, smoke a joint, puffing away, and a ticket collector comes walking along. And points like, oh, because you shouldn't be smoking in the corridor. But I thought to myself, he'll be able to smell that wasn't cigarettes, you know, that's for sure, because the hash has got a really strong smell. So I went back into the cabin and said to my son, the ticket collector just passed there and I was smoking a joint. My son said, well, shall we throw the stuff out of the window? I said, no. We just got off at the next station. Let's just be safe about it. We'll jump off at the next station. And that's what we did. We jumped off at the next station and trying to go through. I didn't have a ticket because the ticket collector had come back to my cabin and asked me for the ticket, and I gave it to him. So when I tried to exit, I couldn't get out the gate. My son walked through, and then the guy on the train who took taken the ticket, pointed his head out, put his head outside the door of the train and pointed to me and shouted something in Chinese. And they stopped me from exiting, so I couldn't go out of the station. And then I was taken into the waiting room. And in the waiting room, I took the 8 kilos or 7 kilos, I'm not sure what it was, put it underneath the chair in the waiting room. And somebody in another room had seen me doing that. And when the police came in, she pointed to the chair. And they went to the chair, discovered the hashish, and then I was arrested. And I was taken to the police station, interrogated. I told my son, don't you mention anything. Don't talk. Don't say you know anything. Just I'm traveling with my father. And that's it. You don't tell him nothing else. So we arrived in Shanghai, taken to a detention center. I was standing in front of a large desk and to sort of itemize your clothing and your property. So I'm taking things out of the bag and they're writing it down. And at the bottom of the bag, there's 8 kilos of hash. I just didn't touch it. I just left it. And then they told me, put everything back in your bag again. I put everything back in the bag and I was taken into a cell. There was 12 people in it. My son was taken somewhere else. I don't know where, didn't know where they had taken him. And 10 days later, the British consul came to visit me and they told me, no, I asked them, where is my son? And they said, oh, your son was released. I said, my son was released? Yeah, your son was released. He went to Hong Kong and he's actually sent me money from Tokyo to pay for a lawyer. So I knew that's impossible unless he took drugs from the prison and sold them, because he didn't have money to go to Tokyo and send me money for a lawyer. But I don't know what he'd done because I'm in prison. I just know that he sent me money. And after being, I was in the detention there for 10 months. Very, very difficult type of the situation and the environment. There was 12 of us in a cell. We slept together, you know, like sardines. There was a hole in the ground. Everybody had to piss and shit in that. So there was a really, really strong smell in the room. And there was no shower then. You don't get a shower or a bath. The whole 10 months, I never get one shower. So my body came out in boils and scabs. And I was there for 10 months. And eventually I went to the court. And on my indictment, I had a death sentence, life sentence. And the minimum sentence was 15 years. So when I went up to court, I was given 15 years. And at that time, I felt quite good because I could have got the death sentence. And I'd heard lots of rumors, you know, in the cell about people being executed and there was people in my cell who did get executed. So it was a sort of a relief to get 15 years. But then when I went down to the cell and thought about it, I thought, 15 years just for hash? Whoa, that's pretty bad, you know, pretty severe. But 10, 15 minutes before, giving me 15 years was like a relief. So the mind just changes sometimes like that.
You mentioned the conditions there, and I mean, you know, you're in a 12-man cell, you're a white man in a foreign country, and I think you paint a brighter picture than probably is. There's no home comforts, there's no bed, you're lying on a wooden slat, there's rats running around, there's cockroaches. This is a real prison, and you're under threat because you're the odd man out. How did you?
Yeah, well, it was horrible. When you're talking, like me talking to you about it, it's just one of those things. But the actual experience of it, it was horrifying, you know, it was terrible. And, you know, the big thing, one of the big things is language barrier. But fortunately enough, there was one guy there, Tai Chi, I called him. His name's not Tai Chi, but he used to do Tai Chi in the morning when he woke up. Hardly any space, but he used to do it. And there was another guy called Charlie Kai, who was a plant, he was an informer. So, and I had some fights in there as well, you know. But what can you do? You're in that situation. It wasn't a good experience, but there's no way out of it. You know, there's no, okay, I want to move to another room. I want my own room sort of thing. Nothing like that. You just got on with what was there.
What were the prison guards like?
You never saw them. Never. Opened the door and then disappeared. You never see them. The prisoners do all the work. They call it's called Lodon. They open the door, one of the prisoners comes out from the cell. They'll do the mopping around outside the cell. They deliver your breakfast. You could have a wash. So you're the basin, so they give you water in the basin. And the guards, the only time I ever saw the guards is when they came to take me downstairs for interrogation. That's the only time I ever saw them. What Not like the main prison. The main prison, you see them every day.
What was the menu like? I can presume it wasn't cordon bleu.
No, it certainly wasn't. It was a tin canister. And in the morning, it's a rice gruel, you know, just like watered rice with maybe pickled cucumber, maybe not a couple of chilies, maybe a half of a chili, and maybe some grated carrot, but pickled. So rice gruel, grated carrot, pickled cucumber, and a half a chili. That was your breakfast. Lunch was the same, but sometimes you'd get a boiled egg. And you always got pickle. And in the evening, the same. It's the same. Nothing really changes. Maybe once a week you would get, I don't know, maybe a chicken wing. So that was the luxury, was getting a chicken wing.
Could you exercise?
No, 12 of us in a cell. The only one that done any exercise was Tai Chi, but Tai Chi, you just stand up and go. You do all that. But you couldn't move the legs or anything. You just stood in one position and breathing. I used to just sit and watch, you know, just watching. No, I couldn't exercise.
You mentioned the language barrier. How did you overcome that?
Well, as I say, in the detention centre, this guy could speak English. So anything I needed to know or any questions, he would tell me. The Chinese language, I didn't understand it at all at that time. I didn't understand that until I went to the main prison, started to learn. But the first 10 months, no, nothing at all.
You described the Chinese language as quite foul. What did you mean by that?
I I've never heard a language more foul. You know, in America will say, "I son of a bitch," or "motherfucker." There, it's always your grandmother, your grandmother, your grandfather. Your grandmother's a fucking whore. And and it's just constant swearing, you know. I learned how to, actually, it got me into trouble, you know, because I learned how to speak like that as well. And sometimes you lose your temper, you know, you get wound up and you tell people, you know, exactly what they told you. You tell them it back again. One of my favorite ones was chodding Yanisopi. Now, Yanisopi is smelly fanny. And chodding Yanisopi wohanani. So that means you shut the fuck up, you smelly fanny, or it'll punch your fucking brains out. So and sometimes you get angry, you say, "Oh, chodding Yanisopi wohanani." And sometimes I get angry and say that to the fucking Communist Party. When I get tortured and hung up with one hand, you know, on a cell, on my tiptoes all night, because I said, stick your communist party up your ass, because they're always putting it into your head. Me, oh, Gong San Dan, yo, me, oh, Sing Song Go, Gong San Dan. Every fucking morning, Gong San Dan in my brains, you know, Communist Party is the greatest. You just get crack up, you know,
yeah,
brainwashed.
I mean, it's a long time to pass. Could you do anything to keep yourself occupied? Could you write? Could you draw? Could you, you know, did you have a particular method to get through the boredom each day?
Yeah, well, for about 7 years. Well, in the because I get transferred to a new prison. I was 7 years or 6.5 years in one prison and 6 years in another prison. So the first prison was rat infested. It was terrible, terrible environment, death row below you, death sentence opposite you. It's cramped, 8-foot cell, 3-foot. Yeah, I mean, you could buy pencil and paper or a pen, and if you wanted to write something, but there was nothing to occupy your time. That was for the first couple of years like that. But I forgot to mention this. They started to take in contracts from outside companies from America. So the products would actually be made in the prison in China and exported to America. It's in the book, Shanghai and Shackled. It's very detailed what happens there. So even French companies, there was Russian companies, there was American companies, and they would make contracts to make, for example, footballs was one of them. Kitchen apron sets, jackets from Russia. Big Ivan, that was the name of the company, Big Ivan. They made these big, thick, you know, winter jackets. So we also got involved in making them. So that was a good time, you know, getting to the factory and working. But most of the time, we just sat around and done nothing.
You had Olympics in jail, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh, it was brilliant. And it's another thing, I better tell you this, cooling party. We had a cooling, the weather is hot. I'm talking hot in the summertime. And they have a cooling party. So the cooling party is, everybody can go outside of the cell block and into the yard. It's a big, big prison. It's got over 5,000 prisoners, 8 brigades. So it's a big, big yard, you know. Where they had basketball and stuff. You could even kick a ball about there sometimes. And then you'd have a live party. Supply you with ice cream, right? And me, an American guy, a Welsh guy, and a German guy, we all met in there. We formed a band called the Reformers. Werner Schmidt, the wee German guy, excellent on guitar. I had 2 plastic bottles with rice in it as maracas. The American guy had a washboard. And the Welsh guy was a singer. And we get moved from brigade to brigade. We were like the Beatles, I'm telling you. Everybody, because every brigade had their own party. So we moved from our brigade to the other brigade, and help, I need somebody, help. And everyone, all the cons are like, yeah, hello. And there was a women's brigade. And we went to the women's brigade, all these beautiful, some beautiful looking women there with their uniforms on. And we're up singing Bob Marley, the Beatles. I sang a Lowndes Wainwright song called Smokey Joe's Cafe. So that was a big, big event, you know, to go out and go singing inside the fucking maximum security prison in Shanghai. But the Olympics things was every year. We had competition football, brigade versus brigade for football. And I would go there. I was one of the team. I was one of the players because I was not bad at football, quite good. And then we'd play. And it was great, great fun, you know. A lot of competition, a lot of fouling, a lot of nuns and dugs and, you know, whoa, but it was great. Great during that period, but the actual prison time wasn't very much much entertainment there. So that was interesting. The cooling parties and the football, tug of war, short sprints. That was quite interesting.
Did you come across the triads in the
Yeah. system? I had one in my wing was called Blackfish. Oh, I liked him. I got on really well with him. My brother sent me a parcel from London. I had maybe 100 pens, blue ink, red ink, green ink, maybe 100 razor blades, G1, aftershave, some colognes, T-shirts, cassettes. I mean, the parcel was so big, you know, it could have lasted me a lifetime. So I started doing a bit of black market trading, and Blackfish was the main man. You couldn't do nothing without him. So me and him linked together, and there was another old guy there called Jing Fung. He was our translator. So I would talk with Jing Fung, and then Blackfish would come and see me, and okay, I want this T-shirt and this pen and this and this. So we started doing a bit of trading. So I was well quoted, because two things: I had all this stuff for trading and I could play football. So I got on quite well with them, you know.
How long did you actually serve in Chinese jail?
In that first prison I'm telling you about, not talking about now, 6.5 years. And then I got transferred to a new, brand new prison. Still in the Shanghai area, just a little bit out of town. And I was there for 6 years also. So total, it was 12 years, 4 months.
Wow. Unbelievable. It's quite harsh, that, because in this country, in the UK, as you know, you get a 15-year sentence, you could be out in 7.5. And it's a harsher regime out there.
Well, actually, now in the UK, you can be out in 5.
Yeah.
It used to be 7.5. It used to be 10. Then it went to 7.5. Then it went down possibly to 5.
Yeah. Incredible.
There's no remission in China. None. You don't get remission. You get resentenced. So you've got to be there a minimum of it, let's say 4 years before they even consider reducing your sentence. And the things that you have to do, you know, they call it ideological remolding. So every week you have to write a report, and you have to write praising the Chinese Communist Party, the prison regime, how you're reforming, how you're learning, how you're studying, how wonderful the government is of China. And you do that on a weekly basis. So after 4 years, they said, okay, you're getting recommended now for a reduction of your sentence. So I was thinking, yes, you know, probably get a couple of years knocked off. They only took 10 months. 10 months reduction. I was like, 10 months? I kissed that much ass for 4 fucking years and only get 10 months? It was unbelievable. I wrote articles about Deng Xiaoping. I wrote articles about Chou Enlai, Mao Zedong, and how great the communists was. And I only get 10 months. I said, fuck this. I'm not doing that anymore. So I stopped doing it.
What was it like that day that you walked out of the prison, a free man?
Oh, what a day. My brother in London has sent me a beautiful suit, you know, a really good quality suit, you know, cracking pair of shoes. And I had been painting all that time. Not all. When I went to the new prison, I got the British Consul to buy me oil paints and canvases. And that's where I taught myself how to paint in prison.
I'll show a few of your pieces of art, because honestly, this fascinates me. I love art. It's an acquired taste. Obviously, everyone sees something different in paintings, but I'm just going to flick through as you talk about that.
So the British Consul, I could buy materials. They brought me canvas, brushes, oils, and paint. And I started teaching myself how to paint. And I really got absorbed in it. I really, really enjoyed it. And I would have to say that would be a sanity saver for me. Because every day they allowed me to sit in a little room on my own and paint. And sometimes even the guards would ask me to do paintings for them. So I was quite occupied with painting, and I really, really enjoyed doing that. And then when it came to the time to be released, as I say, my brother had sent me a beautiful suit and nice shoes, and I was fit, you know. I was in that second prison, they had a small gym. They made a small, first of all, we used to get empty Coca-Cola bottles and put the big ones and put sand in them and do weights, put the handle of a brush and do some weights. And of course, you could always stair run up and down stairs to get your cardio. And then maybe about a year before I was released, they opened a small gym, you know, inside the jail. And we could also use a telephone. That was the first time. It was called, when we went to the prison, this is the warden's speech. Shanghai Qingpu Prison is a modern, civilized prison with a strong emphasis on cultural values. Now, that's his first speech. I told you, we've got to write everything down. Every week, you've got to write an article about the prison. So I started making requests. Well, a modern, civilized prison, I would like to get art materials. That's when I started to get the art materials in. And then they opened a small gym, did all the weights, barbells, heavy weights, squatting, and as I say, stair run. And they allowed my family to send me creatine, protein powder. They could send that to the prison. So I was getting my creatine, protein powder, multivitamins, working out every day. I mean, I was 83 kilo. Oh, no, sorry, 78 kilo. Muscles coming out my neck and everything was like, pfft. And when I get home, all my family went, "I thought you were in prison. It looks like you've just came from a holiday camp." But that was only the last year. When I arrived there back in the UK, yeah, it was a fantastic, the feeling, putting on that suit, I had a roll of paintings under my arm, going down the stairs and then turning around and looking up at all the inmates at their window. And the van was on the yard. And then just waving, arrived at the airport. Oh, the smell of an airport. It's just fantastic, you know. All that scent from different people passing. Went through the customs or immigration, stamped my passport, and then sitting on the plane. Oh, it's very difficult to explain. But a very interesting thing, I'll never, never forget this. That Jack Nicholson movie. No, the Jack Nicholson, what is it? He's crazy. It's not the one who flew over the cuckoo's nest, it's a different one.
Right.
And I was watching that on the plane and tears were just running down my eyes and I was cracking up in laughter. It was so real. It was exactly like in the jail in China. It was total madness. But then arriving, you know, sitting on the plane and eventually arriving in London, they pulled me aside, took me into a room. Do you have any problems with the British government? Do you have any things that you want to take revenge upon? I'm saying, what are you talking about? I've just been released from prison in China. So they're maybe just sussing me out. Maybe I had some psychotic ideas in mind to do something. And then that was it. I went back home.
Amazing story. I mean, the artwork, as I've shown there, fantastic and obviously very therapeutic. You do come back home and, you know, from your perspective, writing the book, which obviously, you know, we are delighted to be publishing for the second time. You, of course, self-published it originally, but we are going to add a little bit more to it. There's obviously photographs, and it's going to be available. It's going to be signed copies on our website, www.badboysbooks.net. That is the brand new cover as well. But yeah, I mean, what made you sit down and write your story?
Yeah, well, while I was in the prison in China, I told you, you have to write. It's part of the program.
Yeah.
It's, as I told you, it's brainwashing, but there it's called Shishan Gaizo, thought reform, Shishan Gaizo, or ideological remolding. Depends which way you want to word it. So we had to write. So I kept a bit of a diary. I kept, you know, a little diary adding to this and adding to that, and put in my monthly ideological report. But on my diary, I'd have some notes for myself. And then when I eventually come home and looking through the notes, and I thought, well, maybe I should try to write a book about it. But I thought, it's too boring, you know, because it was, in my mind, it was just a harsh regime. You know, do this, do that, do this. You know, there was no adventure. Like, well, there was a little bit of adventure, as I said, the cooling party in the Olympic Games. But other than that, it was just a mundane daily life. But then I started to think other people might find these things interesting. Like, in the book, I mentioned about sitting outside and the guys in the yard got a cat and they've got it strapped onto the basketball court. And they're skinning the, first of all, they put it in boiling water and the cat's, wah! You can hear the screams, you know. Then they tie it up on your basketball court pole and skin it. So that's quite horrific. But some other people maybe find that was quite an interesting thing to happen. Not that they would approve of it, but at least it was something out of the ordinary. And then the guys directly below being on death row, they'd been executed within 10 days. And a little box outside of the floor below, you went in, they went in there and were given the option to donate their heart, liver, eyes, lungs, whatever they wanted to donate. And the truth of the matter is, if they didn't donate it, they were still getting taken anyway. So, but at least they gave them the option. So things like that, I thought that might be quite interesting for people to know. And the opposite building as well, directly opposite us, was also death row, but they had an opportunity to go back to court and possibly get their death sentence commuted to life sentence. So living amongst that sort of a environment, the way I explained it was, you just become used to it. And it's not a nice thing to say, but I didn't know it at the time, but when I came out of prison, started to write the book, yeah, I did get a lot of emotions arising. Sometimes I'd get tears in my eyes, you know, like feel, yeah, I remember that. That wasn't, oh, that was sad. And, oh, they shot him. And then the emotions would go down again. And I just continued to write it. I guess in a way it's a form of therapy to get it out of my system. And I didn't know, I never heard of the word as PTSD. I never heard of that before. Until I came out of prison. And at my brother at that time, my brother was doing a life sentence for the murder of the six of the Doyle family. But he had been released on a miscarriage of justice. And he'd spent about 20 years in prison and was a miscarriage of justice. And then he started inviting me to go to this group called Mojo, Miscarriage of Justice Organization. It's run by a little guy called Paddy Hill. You might know of Paddy. One of the Birmingham
Six. I met him actually on a visit years ago when I was visiting Reggie Cray in Gartree Prison. I met Paddy.
So Paddy turned out to be a friend of mine as well. And then they started talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was thinking, what's that? But I didn't know I was suffering from it. Because, yeah, I just didn't know. And, I sort of knew that I didn't want to live in Glasgow anymore. And that's what I thought, I'm going to head out to some Buddhist monastery or, you know, sort of a look within myself. Because the start of the story I was telling you about going to India to find the meaning of me. Well, I sort of found a lot of myself in the prison in China. I found a lot of things. You do a lot of introspect. And you realize sometimes you're a fucking idiot. You know, you're stupid. The things that you've done, like you mentioned, Mark, getting false ID and this, and you just think you're, what, you know, you don't think about it at the time, but when you've got all that time to sit down in your cell and look back on it, then you think, well, that wasn't very clever. And taking your sons out smuggling, that wasn't very clever or very responsible. But at that time, I just didn't think about that. You know, that's not the way my mind worked. So coming out, realizing that I had changed a lot, and I changed a lot for the better, but it was a harsh experience, a hard lesson learned.
Yeah. You taught a little bit of English as well, didn't you, Logan?
Well, since COVID started, I've not been teaching. But I taught at an Islamic university here for 6 years also.
And this is in Indonesia now, sorry, isn't it? That's where you live.
Yeah, now I'm in Indonesia, but that photograph is in Cambodia, teaching in Cambodia. And here I taught in Indonesia, I taught at an Islamic university for 6 years. And I also taught children done an anti-drug exhibition. And yeah, you know, I've been trying to do some good things, you know. I mostly stay alone. I like to be alone. I like my own company. I enjoy writing. I enjoy painting. But sometimes, like just yesterday, one of the ladies at the university sent me a message. Oh, Mr. Locke, can you help me? I'm doing my postgraduate degree, and I need a foreigner to sponsor me to read my English and correct the grammar. And so that was just yesterday I got a message. So she'll come over to the house maybe in the next few days. She's already written a book for children. She wants me to to proofread it, make sure that the grammar's correct. So I still do little bits, but not much now.
You also wrote a second book, which we are going to publish, which is called The Saffron Assassin. And I think that is a rather striking image. And it's one which, of course, you painted yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's just, there's something about this. I don't know if it's good. That's the problem, because I wrote it. I read it. Some at the beginning, I think, well, it's a bit slow. But then my mind says, well, sometimes things have to build up. But it's all based on a true story. The one reporter came out to Cambodia to do a newspaper article on me. And the newspaper article was called "Ex-Gangster Brings Karma to Cambodia's Killing Fields."
Yeah.
And one day we were sitting at the beach. And often, you know, one time he took me out for a meal with another friend of mine, and he offered me, you want one of those ladies? You know, all the expenses is on us, you know? And I says, don't you ever fucking offer me human flesh again, you bastard. Just don't fucking do that again. I'm getting my robes and all that on. He's asking me, you want a bit of this? So I said, fuck off. And then the next day we're down at the beach, and we're sitting at the beach, and he looked at me and he says, you're the Saffron Assassin. That's his words, that's not my title. That title came from him. He said, you're the Saffron Assassin. And I said, that's a good name for a book. And it was left at that. Never thought about it. Months and months and months passed, I don't know. And then one day, I thought, okay, I'll try and write something about this. I wrote this about 6 years ago and just left it. I didn't think about it anymore. Yeah. It was very emotional. It was too, it's not nice, you know. It's not a nice story, to be honest with you. It's not very friendly. Because there's a lot of murders and killings and really horrific killings. And the mindset, there's a twist, a really clever twist on it. With the Japanese and Koreans coming, and they're doing the killings. I've done the first couple of killings, and I continue to do, you know, one here and there. But the other people, the Japanese and the Koreans that come over, whoa. I just grot them, you know. They're chopping their heads off and their dicks and their fuck, oh my God. And so I don't know how this book will be taken. People maybe look at it and read it and say, wow, yeah, fantastic. That's the way you treat those bastards. Or they maybe say, that fucking author's a sick cunt. You don't know what people are going to say, you know.
What's the aims for these books? Because obviously from your perspective, I guess, you know, especially the you know, your own personal story in Shanghai'd and Shackled, it would be good to get it on to the movie screen. And I mean, you know, got a great photograph of you and a very famous Scottish actor, Robert Carlyle.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting you say that. That Locked Up Abroad, they contacted me and they secured the story for 2 years. They said, we want to make a movie about this. And they only paid me £500, but the £500 was for that I don't give it to anyone else. And they said, okay, sign the contract. They gave me the £500. And then 2 years passed. Nothing happened. So I just let it go. I don't know who to contact. It is an interesting story for the fact that at that time I was the longest serving British prisoner in China, having a death sentence. It could have been an interesting movie, a bit like, you know, Midnight Express or something, a bit similar to that.
Yeah. Well, never say never, Lucky, never say never. Obviously, we're publishing the books, fingers crossed it leads to something like that and somebody is esteemed.
That's true. If it gets out there and somebody can read it, but I think the Saffron Assassin would make a better one, you know. I don't know if it's better.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's up for the readers to decide. Badboysbooks.net is where you can buy both books, and we will have limited edition signed copies. Lucky is signing stickers, and we'll be sending them over from Indonesia. We will get them in time to stick into the book, so don't miss out. Get a pre-order for the book, you know, as soon as you stop watching this podcast today, and we look forward to bringing it out. Just want to finish off really on what your relationship is like with your sons. We've got a couple of photographs here. This one, which is lovely. I love black and white images. And which son is this?
That's my oldest son, Scott. Mm. We have a great relationship. Really fantastic. Really, it's like a little bit like two pals, you know. He shoots from the lip and I shoot from the lip. We talk straight, you know, no beating about the bush. If I do something he doesn't like, he'll say, hey, don't do that. Or if I do something that I like, he'll thank me. Say, oh, that was really good, Dad. You done that. It was good that you helped those people, or you sent them a pen for charity or to raise funds to help people. So we have a really, really good relationship. And my youngest son, Lockie, the one with the gun, because he was just a baby, you know. I never really got to know him. But we did do a bit of traveling together. And he's very independent. He doesn't listen to anybody. What he wants to do, he does. But he's a good guy. He's now in his 40s. In his 20s and 30s, he was wild, you know. That's me again with my grandson.
I'm going to say you're a grandfather now. What's that like?
I'm a great-grandfather now.
A great-granddad, wow.
Yeah, Josh, the little one in the 40 now, he loves football. He plays football, and he's supposed to be very good. And then my son has a daughter called Ashton, and she's got two children. So they're great-grandchildren now.
And there's the photo of Lockie. You mentioned the gun.
Yeah, he's still like that, wild, you know.
Chip off the old block.
You're correct again, yes.
Great stuff. It's been a fascinating podcast. Really, really enjoyed it. And obviously, thank you for giving us the opportunity at Bad Boys Books to bring your books out. Looking forward to getting the final manuscript over to you just for you to check. We're busy going through those now. The proofreader's got them. Hopefully, by the end of this week, this Friday, Shanghai and Shadow will be back with you and you'll be able to look at it. But people, as I say, you can pre-order it from badboysbooks.net. And the second book, which many of you will be looking forward to reading, The Saffron Assassin, which we've talked about, the cover, of course, designed by Lockie himself, is again available as a pre-order from badboysbooks.net. I think we're in the process of doing 100 stickers for each of those books. So there will be 100 signed copies. We will number them 1 to 100. So there will be special editions, collector's editions, if you like, and well worth getting a copy. And I'm sure that we'll be able to help you out on getting onto a couple of other bigger podcasts. Ours is good, but it's would be good to get you on some bigger platforms. Potentially Sean Atwood would be a good one. I know he loves to do stuff about former prisoners who were locked up in other prisons, Lockie. So it might be good for you to get out and do something like that as well, because you've got a great story to tell. And just to flick through a couple of the comments, lots of people have tuned in today, and he loved the story. UKPI loved the story of you about you going off to Europe for 8 months, which I think is
see it there. It's about Europe, brilliant.
Ed says that it's a fascinating story. He also says, when we make money illegally, it gives us the ability to control our environment and avoid responsibility for a while at least.
He's spot on again.
The casual observer just says, a great watch this. He really enjoyed it. Kev said it was a great watch as well. Ed was in prison himself and says, art kept me sane in prison, so I can relate to that, brother. So
yeah, it did. Yeah.
True Crime Adventure says, great story. And finishing off with Gola Shorts, who says, really appreciate the content from both of you. So that's really
okay.
Nice. So
thank you, Gola Shorts.
Some nice feedback, mate. Some really nice feedback. And thanks for your time. I will let you get back to your life in Indonesia. And thanks for sparing the time this morning. And I will be in touch very soon, mate. Hopefully by the end of the week, to let you know where we're up to with the books. But it's been a fascinating almost an hour and a half, so very, very good, mate.
I'm a gab.
Great stuff, mate. Speak to you soon. Take care. God bless.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it, Steve. Bye-bye.